Good evening. I'm going to say just two words, and the two words are, welcome to the New York Public Library. I'm the Director of Public Programs, now known as Live from the New York Public Library. It is a delight to be hosting this last day of Islam in Europe, and now it is my great pleasure to introduce to you Manaz Fancy.
Thank you, Paul. Good evening, everyone. As Paul mentioned, I'm Manaz Fancy, and I'm the Director of Development at the Alliance of Civilizations Media Fund. I always need to breathe in the middle of it. And we've been a collaborating partner in this three-day program on Islam in Europe. I'd like to thank Live from the New York Public Library and the European Union National Institutes for Culture for organizing this in conjunction with the 10-day Muslim Voices Arts and Ideas Festival, which was organized by BAM, Asia Society, and the new NYU Center for Dialogues. In particular, I'd like to thank my friends and co-conspirators in Islam in Europe, Paul Holdengraber, Martin Rachbauer, and Zeba Rahman. You have been such a pleasure to work with. Tonight, we are presenting Media, a Catalyst for Change, the fourth of five panels in this important discussion that permits a fascinating perspective on one of the most urgent issues in our world today, the relationship between the Muslim and Western societies in Europe and beyond. Over the last 2 days, we have looked at Islam in Europe as an issue from various angles, the history behind it, which traces all the way back to the medieval ages with the Crusades, and to more recent history in terms of colonialism and empire, the situation we find ourselves in today, which is produced by the migration of populations from all over the Muslim world, looking for economic opportunity and political freedom in Europe, and then the particular identity of Muslim European youth who find themselves negotiating a complicated identity as European citizens who are simultaneously marginalized because they are only seen in terms of the stereotypes and misconceptions that have dominated the world since 9/11. Our speakers have compared and contrasted the differences and similarities between the Muslims in the US and Europe in rich and provocative conversations involving some of the finest thinkers on both sides of the pond. The issue that emerges most strikingly here is that the relationship between Muslim and Western societies is fraught with miscommunication and misconceptions that stem from the negative stereotypes of Muslims and Islam. According to the 2008 Gallup poll, What a Billion Muslims Think, a majority of Muslims all over the world said that the most important thing to improve this relationship would be if the West could know as much about Islam and the Muslim and Muslim culture as we know about the West and its culture. Therefore, public education, cultural diplomacy becomes as crucial as other forms of diplomacy, which is why this program and the Muslim Voices Festival as a whole is so heartening to Muslim New Yorkers like me. On to our topic, cultural diplomacy. This is where media comes in. Where art, music, and literature serve to open our eyes to people in other parts of the world or different cultures, media is the primary platform through which stories and worldviews from across the world are shared. Today, the global reach of TV, film, and new media present the most powerful, tool for, for reaching across the divide and improving our conversation across the divide. With that, I will stop. I'd like to introduce my colleague, Shamil Idris, the Executive Director of the Alliance of Civilizations Media Fund, who will introduce our esteemed panel for tonight and tell you how the Alliance of Civilizations Media Fund has a mission to bring media into focus for this urgent issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Manaz, and thank you, Paul, for having us here. And thank you all for spending your evening with us tonight. We have a little bit over an hour to hear from a very esteemed group of panelists here. And so I'm going to get right to the issue. I may intervene from time to time to tell you a little bit about what the Alliance of Civilizations Media Fund is doing in this area. But we're here primarily to hear from our panelists, and I'll be introducing them one at a time. First, I'd like to start with our esteemed panelist who really needs no introduction, which is Her Majesty Queen Noor, who's going to set the stage for us a bit tonight. Her Majesty really does need no introduction, but I'm going to try anyway. She is an international public servant. a tireless activist on issues of world peace and justice. She is engaged as a leading spokesperson and advocate on issues ranging from refugee rights to disarmament to conflict, international conflict resolution. On this specific issue of using media as a catalyst for furthering cross-cultural understanding, and particularly between Western and predominantly Muslim societies, she's shown a special leadership. In 2007, she launched with the New York Tribeca Film Festival the Media and Humanity Program. We've been very pleased at the Media Fund to be involved in some of those screenings, and they're really quite eye-opening and inspiring. In 2007, also at the Cannes International Film Festival, she launched Cinema Verite, which is a program to foster international film with a social conscience. And with that, I'd like to start the panel by asking you, Your Majesty, first, thank you for being with us. And, you know, you were pulled in so many different directions and asked to do so much, and you do so much. Why this particular issue of navigating cross-cultural identities, and why media in particular? Why is this so important to you?
Well, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I also want to add my thanks to our hosts and sponsors, especially the New York Public Library and the European Union National Institutes for Culture, and for my colleagues at the Alliance of Civilizations Media Fund for producing this event, and of course for the organizers of the larger festival, Muslim Voices, Arts and Ideas. What a timely moment this is for there hasn't been an untimely moment, but this is a particularly timely, I think, and encouraging moment for this kind of focus, and for us at the Media Fund, this is a great opportunity. Thank you for the platform that we have this evening to talk a little bit about our work and why we believe that the research that we have undertaken that we will begin to introduce tonight is of enormous importance, we think, and a resource and valuable asset in trying to make the case that I think we will all share in trying to make this evening on this panel of the importance of media, not only in ways that we have seen, sadly, disproportionately, the negative impact of media in terms of cross-cultural relations, in terms of the way that it's been used politically to polarize different groups within countries, within societies, as well as among cultures and civilizations. And also, our research points out, and it builds on research already undertaken in this country over many decades to focus on intergroup relations in this country, Arab-American, the challenge of Arab-Americans in this country, of other minority groups. Our research has taken that beyond to show how media can be used to humanize and to bridge the divides between different groups that are polarized, may be polarized for different reasons at any moment in time. So from my personal perspective, I was actually asked to speak for, I think, a disproportionately long period of time at the outset of this. But I would just locate myself in the context of this group by saying that maybe most people know, I'm not quite sure, but my grandparents arrived at Ellis Island from Lebanon, from Beirut, and at the end of the century before last, and they were Orthodox Christian immigrants. I grew up in a Judeo-Christian society here in the United States with all of the privileges and blessings of that, became a Muslim and married a Hashemite direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and have spent over 30 years now trying to work to bridge some of the divides that will come up in this conversation and have already been discussed in the course of this festival. So that is why I personally am committed. It's 30 years of living in the Middle East, 30 years of traveling around the world to a wide range of conflict regions, and working on a range of different conflict recovery, conflict and conflict prevention issues, and in most of these cases, media had a very important role to play, both in as a catalyst in many cases for conflict, and when used by those groups who, thank God, are increasing in number around the world, as a way to promote reconciliation and an understanding of the common bonds we share, the common values, common aspirations, no matter among which cultures, societies, ethnic groups, religious groups, tribes, that it can be a very potent force for healing and for developing a sense of solidarity and community that is the path to peace.
Well, thank you very much. You mentioned research, and I should mention the research that Her Majesty has noted. We at the Media Fund have funded at Harvard, MIT, and the New School for Social Research, really looking at the impact that visual media has on issues of identity formation and intergroup relations. And we'll cite some of those findings as we go. But since you mentioned research, I want to turn to probably one of our lead researchers on the panel, which Emanuela Castano, who is at the New School for Social Research, and who's a social and political psychiatrist with an expertise in nationalism. What did I call it? I'm sorry?
You call me psychiatrist.
Oh, my apologies. My apologies.
We need that.
I might need that.
Newly licensed.
There's no couch on the stage, unfortunately. With an expertise in nationalism, international relations, and conflict resolution. And you've contributed chapters to a number of books, but the one I want to note here, particularly relevant for our conversation, because a lot of this discussion is also about navigating identities in Europe, is the Handbook of Experimental Existential Psychology and Transnational Identities, Becoming European in the EU. I'm very interested, Emmanuel. Can you speak more from a general perspective? We have people on this panel who are activists on the ground doing things. You're really looking at how people go about navigating multiple identities in our increasingly diverse and complicated world. Can you talk a little bit about what processes that entails and connect it to what's happening in Europe today from your perspective?
Sure. As many of you know, Europeans have been handling multiple loyalties and identities for quite a while. Certainly, with the emerging European identity, embryonic, sometimes catatonic after attempts to pass European constitution. But there are also other identities that have been important to Europeans for centuries, regional and national identities. And so we're all, I'm Italian, I often here in Europe particularly define myself as European, and they're all important and become relevant at different times. And they have different content. You know, regional identities are primarily, if not exclusively, ethnocultural identities in Europe, with some exception where they become politicized. And the European, emerging European identity is primarily a civic identity. But of course, you know, the political discourse is still dominated by national identities because they have the two elements, both an ethnocultural component and the strong civic component that has been reinforced by in some cases at least 150 years, but in some cases for a few centuries, by common institutions and practices. And so the issue becomes really why these national identities are dominating, and from the research in social psychology, but also in social science in general, the perspectives, I would say probably the dominant perspective, is that there is nothing really essential about these identities. They are continuously created, maintained, and contested in everyday life. And that's good news, I think, if we are attempting and hoping for change and for inclusion of minorities in these identities, because it's a matter of political struggle, in a way. And I think this is not only for a majority non-Muslim members to speak about the specific issue at hand, but also from the perspective of Muslim minorities within European countries. I mean, I think a good example is the British Muslims. And different voices are present in Britain, one perhaps represented by the Muslim Parliament of Great Britain, on the one hand, who argues for the importance and primacy of Islamic identity, both as religious and political, and criticize any involvement in British political life because that is detrimental to this Islamic identity. On the other hand, you have other forces in the UK, fortunately, I would say, more representative, who argue for the opposite. And both quote the Prophet, peace be upon him, and interpret in extremely different ways. The same quotes are interpreted in ways that support their view of identity. In one case, compatible to a British civic identity; in the other case, absolutely incompatible. But I think for us, the good news is there's nothing essentialist about the identities. We create them and we believe in it. They're a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy.
Let me just ask you quickly as a follow-up. You talk about these being contested and not static. You know, one of the things that the research that we funded has found is that when people see images of communities with which they empathize or relate being victimized or humiliated, that grows in them a stronger sense of affiliation with that identity. Do you see that, and does the research bear that out, that the identity that you assert most strongly may be the one that you feel is most under attack, or is that a falsehood?
It is. There is nothing like a negative common fate to boost a sense of belonging and identity. And there is a lot of evidence now that we can experience emotions vicariously when we see our own people victimized in any context and for any social identity, gender identity, sexual identity, national identity, and so on. So that is certainly true. And I think that these images are problematic. And actually, I think the debate is, as of last night in the news, whether or not to release this, the last documents from the CIA interrogations. And the debate is this going to be, is going to fuel the propaganda or not? It is an interesting question. But I think that's exactly what the research is, that the Alliance is funding is trying to establish.
This is actually, you've led quite nicely into the next two panelists that I wanted to turn to, because you've talked about two things. And the first, and I'm going to turn to you, Andrea. Andrea Travis Dam is a dramatist from Denmark who won critical acclaim when you developed a play called The Hijab Monologues. And it was really when you developed them in the midst of the Danish cartoon controversy in January of 2006. This issue of images and humiliation and how that can cause people to assert more strongly, the identity they feel is under attack. You were on the ground and you did not shy away from this issue. You actually went directly at it. I'm curious if you could just tell us a little bit about what your experience was with that. What was the reaction? What did you find?
Yeah, I'd love to. I mean, my experience is that fiction in this case, or storytelling, is a huge and powerful tool. I think in the case of the hijab monologues or headscarf monologues...
I should have asked you to explain briefly to us the hijab monologues. What was the play?
I interviewed or met, I'd like to call it more, over 100 women all living in Denmark. Only some of them bearing a headscarf, some of them hating headscarves, some of them spitting at women wearing headscarves, some of them couldn't care less about headscarves. So a very different range, a Catholic nun wearing a headscarf, a very different range of women. From those 100 women, 18 women were selected, and so the hijab monologues, or maybe the translation should be headscarf monologues, is 18 monologues. And they are very different, they present very different truths and almost always contrasting truth. And what I found was that with these hijab monologues, it did more than just change opinions, it actually changed behavior. So in that sense, I think it's a huge and powerful tool. But I met that in my process of writing them, I was fighting that powerful tool as well, which was, for example, the director of the play and of the theater were asking me, repeatedly shouting at me that I wasn't doing my research right, because where were the stories of the women being raped on their wedding night? Where were the stories of the women leaving their family because they want to become suicide bombers? Where were the stories of women being beaten up by their husband because they refused to wear the hijab or the scarf? So we had to acknowledge that there were certain stories that were expected. And, this is by an intellectual creative class in Denmark. This is not just, anybody. So we had to acknowledge that part of our audience would also expect those stories. And then the fight was for me to keep adding the stories that were not proving and confirming that what we suspected or that what some people expect, but to come with other stories. And I think I had to use a few tricks to do that, catch the audience off guard. I found a lot of the time that people are very much on guard as soon as it is about these issues. They have decided what they think is right and what is their truth, and it's very hard for them to meet or be open about another truth. And this is where I think that media, especially when we talk fiction, has an enormous potential, because the thing that is very different when you go to fiction, this play was performed by three very Danish-looking and very famous actresses. So the thing that happens to this audience is they come in, they sit down, they relax, and they open up, like they would do when they go to a fiction or a film, because there what you do is you identify with the character. because otherwise you can't follow the story. So what you want to do is to identify. So this is what the audience was doing with these stories, but normally it is the opposite of what you do when you read the newspaper or you meet someone that's very opposite to you. You have already decided, I don't like you. So these women were not wearing scarves. They were looking very Danish, and they were... So this is one of the ways. There's a few other ways how we trick the audience into being maybe open-minded and having to identify themselves.
We haven't done that here. I'm sorry.
We're trying.
We're trying, yeah.
Just wait.
We don't need to do it here, I'm sure.
I'm sure. But one of the other ways was that I think of all the of the 18 monologues, there was none of them that in the beginning tells us if the woman was wearing a scarf or not. So some of them told it halfway or at the end. Some of them didn't tell it at all. So very easily it becomes very irrelevant whether this woman was wearing a scarf. What became irrelevant was was the woman behind the scarf.
I mean, it's interesting because although they're probably many people wouldn't include theater, you know, onstage theater in media, but the real link is this issue of storytelling, I think, that you've hit right on. And I don't mean to keep doing this, but you keep prompting each of you some of these research findings. One of the other research findings, and I'm always aware of the two people on my left because I'm a pretender when it comes to academia, so if I get this wrong, tell me. But one of the research findings also that we found is that issues of identity formation and what people what their attitudes are around group identity, their own and that of others, is really processed at least as much or more through emotional experience as it is through rational, you know, deliberation. And so, and this is obvious in some ways, like you've just put it, if you read a story of Hurricane Katrina victims in this country versus seeing something on television where people are suffering, you have a completely different experience. And the emotional power of media, theatrical plays, I think probably reaches people on a level and might challenge people's notions of identity, their own and others, in ways that you can't necessarily do by arguing with them about facts,
what you believe is true.
I do want to turn, Mohammed, to you. Mohammed El-Fattahchi is the CEO and founder of Muxlim.com, which is a Finnish social media company serving a Muslim lifestyle and market. It's actually the largest Muslim social networking website. It has, if I'm right, 1.5 million monthly visitors and 150,000 registered users. And in addition to marketing to Muslim communities, it also provides space for exchange, blogging, video sharing, this kind of thing. You know, one of the things that Emanuele said that I wanted to pick up on is this issue of political and religious identity, and then other kinds of identity. He mentioned that in the UK, one of the things that happens is that British Muslims oftentimes are encouraged to really put forward, defend, assert the political and religious identity, whereas there's a counter trend to push. You said the opposite, but you didn't define what the opposite is, and I actually want to turn to Mohammed to define that. Can you tell us a little bit about these different kinds of identity and how you use new media to try and get at this issue?
Sure. So from the moment when we have started the social media platform, the focus was always on Muslim lifestyle as opposed to just being Muslim or any other definition. And by lifestyle, we mean that when we went and asked British Muslims, tell us about your Muslim lifestyle, it seems that that definition has been over the years distorted a bit. They started to speak about how religious they are, when in fact it wasn't really what we were asking about. When we got another group of Muslims and we asked them, please tell us about your lifestyle, simply, then they started to say all of the things that they do in their daily life that may or may not be influenced by their identity and their religion. So this is the definition of Muslim lifestyle that we try to enforce on a network. It basically putting everything into perspective, not making being Muslim only about religious or political messages, but rather being Muslim is something that transcends all what we do in our lives, and basically the fashion, the sports, music, entertainment, and all of that is basically a very, very important part of our identity as a whole. So this is what we've been emphasizing. We reach people in 190 countries here on the network. So definitely everybody is represented. We also we also feel very strongly that new media and social media is the only opportunity for both producers and consumers of that media to be both in their own comfort zone. So there's no friction whatsoever. People who may not necessarily be connected to traditional media streams or may not necessarily perhaps go and attend a play or watch a movie, they're still being represented, they still have an equal voice, and they're able to reach other people who may not necessarily be interested in listening to them.
And how, I mean, I hate to make you representative of an entire group of people, but you have no choice because you're our only Muslim who happens to live in Europe on the stage. So we're talking about understand Muslim identity in Europe. I mean, both from your own experience and in running the company, can you talk a little bit about these issues of contested identities and how you see things playing out now? I mean, I'm very wary, being an American, of putting too fine a point on this, of what's happening in other places. But we do see, it seems, in several European countries, a shift politically to the right, oftentimes on issues of attitudes towards immigrants and attitudes towards Muslim minorities and other minorities, Jews as well, and not happening everywhere, but in multiple countries right now. And I guess I'm curious, what is your sense, of, what is your perspective of what's happening?
Well, I completely agree that there is definitely a sense of expecting to hear something when a Muslim is even featured in the media. So I just remember a story when a journalist from a very, very important European newspaper wanted to interview me, and the article had a personal perspective. And he basically said that, let's go around Helsinki to all of the places that really matter to you, and then I will, you know, take pictures of you there and discuss those places with you. And he said, so therefore, let's start from mosque so-and-so. And I told him that, you know, why did you assume that mosque would be one of the places that I'll even choose? And then later I communicated to him that although the mosque is an important part of me, I don't necessarily feel that I have to go to a specific mosque and portray that as part of my Muslim lifestyle. My Muslim lifestyle is running a company. My Muslim lifestyle is reaching so many people and becoming a media entrepreneur. This is my Muslim lifestyle, and being Muslim and believing in Islam affects definitely all that, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the mosque has to be the starting point.
Thank you. We also have on our stage a world-renowned political theorist in Benjamin Barber. He's a distinguished senior fellow at Demos. He's president and director of the international non-governmental organization CivWorld at Demos. He's written 17 books, is right? You haven't written another one since I got this 2 days ago. 17 books, including many of the books touched directly on these issues, but one of the first ones that I read was Jihad versus McWorld, which captures, you know, in a very provocative phrase, many of the themes. He's received many honors, a knighthood from the French government, the Berlin Prize of the American Academy of Berlin, the John Dewey Award. And he's authored, he's written in so many scholarly and popular publications and periodicals, I'm not going to even begin listing them. Professor Barber, you've heard this, you've studied these issues and written about them for a long time. Can you react a little bit to what you've heard and maybe put forward some of the questions that you see?
Thank you, Shamil. I will try to do that, and I'll try to comment a little on what we've heard and bring it back to Her Majesty's initial putting on the table of, I think, what is the crucial issue this evening, which is the role of media in exploring all the kinds of things that we've talked about here and over the last several days, the issues that have been put on the table with regard to the role of Islam in the world, in the Western world, the intercultural, intercivilizational dialogue between the Muslim world and the Western world. And the comment I want to make is, Her Majesty said quite specifically that the media can play a positive role, and she's extremely diplomatic, more diplomatic than I am, probably. And since I'm an American academic, I can afford perhaps to be a little more blunt about these things than some of the other people in the room might want to be. And I want to be a little bit blunt because while she generously said the media can play a role that can help heal, can help bridge, can help humanize, I think we all know, whether we're talking about cable television, whether we're talking about Hollywood, whether we're talking about even the new media, that it often fails to do that and instead does something much worse. It demonizes rather than humanizes. It divides rather than bridges. It doesn't reconcile but pushes people apart. And I think we have to be very aware of that, because what I think I just heard here on stage was three or four wonderful examples of what real dialogue, what real information, what real knowledge, what real debate and discussion does. It deepens, it complicates, it problematizes, it gets us to see sides that we didn't expect, it challenges our prejudices or just even the generalities that we live by, and makes us see things a little bit differently. Certainly the data in the study, Emmanuel, that you pointed to, suggests understandings of European identity that are not essentialist, and you made that point very clearly. Often in Europe, we talk about European Christians up against Muslim immigrants. Problem is, a lot of Europeans aren't very Christian. particularly the ones who self-identify as Christian. The Pope recently complained that European Catholics are in eclipse and that in many ways Europe is no longer a Catholic entity. So you can't make that generalization. And of course, an awful lot of Muslims aren't immigrants. An awful lot of Muslims are Europeans, not just first, but second and third generation Europeans. And their Muslim religious background is only one dimension of a genuinely European identity. But we tend to jump to the conclusion, helped by the media, that when you talk about Muslims in Europe, you're talking about the other, about outsiders, about non-Europeans, and therefore you are faced with the problem of integration or assimilation, you know, how to fit them in. And as my friend Tariq Ramadan said to me last week in Istanbul, he said, you know, people say, how are we going to fit you in? He said, actually, you know, I've been fit in for several generations. I'm a Swiss citizen teaching in Oxford. He still can't get into the United States because he's seen here as a dangerous outsider. But in fact, he's a European who happens to be a Muslim and takes that very seriously and incorporates that part of his identity. So that's one form of complexification that you're deepening and the sort of thing that we wish the media did more. Andrea talked about the tricks of art, the tricks of fiction. And of course, the great thing about art is that, you know, art is about the illusion of reality. And it's through illusion that we actually often get to realities that are deeper than what real journalism gets us. And clearly what you did also is get Danes to face up to the fact that their preconceptions and prejudices about what may be a Muslim immigrant who wore a veil or didn't a hijab or not thought and looked like, and obviously in your work you made it very clear it's much more complicated. It's, you know, behind each veil or behind each face that isn't veiled is a complex human being who has many identities, some of which you can agree with and some of which look different, but it's much more complicated. In doing that, you humanized the situation, you created an atmosphere in which tolerance is possible. But again, you did what media so often don't do. You know, you challenged and contradicted.
Could I react
please
to it? Because
do,
I
yes.
think it has a part to do with the pace. You know, the normal media has to tell stories now within 2 minutes or within one headline or has to paint a picture of a figure within half a minute. In the hijab monologues or in fiction, therefore I think this cinema varieté has a huge future or a huge potential, we have 2 hours in a fiction film. Or I had 10 minutes per person to get in depth and show. You know, it's a different pace. So in that sense, it's easy to blame the media, but we can't expect from them to do the same. So I think we will be disappointed after and after again because they only have this pace.
Well, that's a wonderful point. Anyone who watches CNN or any cable network knows that every interview starts with, we only have a minute now, and in a minute you quickly say, you know, before you've even been asked anything, you're being told your time is up.
That's if it's not a four-word Twitter.
And so on. Exactly.
Tweet.
And Twitter and tweeting and so on has in fact turned necessity into a virtue, but not much of a virtue. So you're exactly right. But again, time, deliberation, that's not. And then, Mohammed, what you said, again, you have a website that allows Muslims to go on and find a variety of representations of themselves, their culture, their lifestyle, their variety.
And non-Muslims, their differences. By the way, 5%.
Terrific. There you are. So once again, using new media to, in a sense, complicate, problematize identity in a way that helps us all understand that as human beings, we are all distinctive, but we share commonalities, and that allows us both to see our distinctives and commonalities. But now comes to your question, Your Majesty, what does the media do to help this? Not much. Very, very little. And by media here, I don't just mean cable television and local papers and so on. I particularly mean that part of media that have a far greater influence on us. I mean Hollywood, I mean Madison Avenue, I mean the media, you know, I mean most of us spend a little time watching TV, kids go to school a few hours, 6 hours a day for 30 weeks a year, but we are exposed to advertising, to Hollywood, to television, 60 or 70 hours a week for all our lives, 52 weeks a year. So what goes on there is a kind of invisible pedagogy that is much more important in shaping what we think and how we see the world than any of the things that happen in a classroom or happen in, you know, on a website. And there, I fear, the very things that are being challenged on this stage and have been challenged over the last couple of days are constantly reinforced and reinforced. When Hollywood came to the end of the Cold War, they didn't breathe a sigh of relief. They said, oh my God, who will be the villains now? And there was, of course, an easy target after 1989. the Muslim world and specifically the Arab Muslim world. A little complicating factor, there are about 1.3 billion Muslims on Earth. Actually, about 250 million of them are Arab, but that doesn't matter in Hollywood. Every Muslim is an Arab. Every Arab is a Muslim. We've got a new enemy. And if you look, you know, at the plots of the films and so on, the heavies nowadays tend to be Arab and or Muslim with very little discrimination beyond there. It's easy to create a stereotype. And so what the media do at their worst, they're not always at their worst, as the Queen has said, but they often are, instead of challenging stereotypes, they pander to, reinforce, and confirm stereotypes without even trying. If you go to a good Hollywood thriller, you have a great time and you enjoy yourself, and it hardly registers that three or four of the villains actually looked kind of Arab, kind of brown-skinned, and maybe said Inshallah once in a while, or praise be to God, and so that sort of, or mentioned Muhammad coming and going, and, you know, they didn't say, oh, Jesus, they said something else, and so you kind of got the hint. And without knowing it, over time, the stereotype of a Muslim as the new villain to replace the Russian, or the Cold Warrior, or the Pole, has taken hold in the popular imagination. And getting around that in young people by having lessons, by schoolwork, by good media is very, very tough because they are exposed in a permanent way. So I think the challenge that we face, and I obviously you're going to respond to that, I hope you will, but I think we really need to come to terms with the challenge of conventional, ubiquitous commercial media and the way in which they constantly work against everything we just witnessed here on stage.
And not just here, but in the rest of the world. Because in the Arab and the Muslim world, and I imagine in much of the rest of the world, about 80% of the films that are shown in movie houses are from Hollywood. That figure is going to be changing soon as industries are getting better organized, and the Shama might even address that. But to date, generations have been influenced by these images of that America has of them. And so that is the other side of the coin. It's not just how generations are impacted here through Hollywood and a variety of the different media platforms, including, of course, video games and others that are particularly insidious and are really, I think, watched more than anything else, perhaps, right now by young people. I think this is where our media fund comes in recognizing that commercial films do have exactly the kind of impact that you're talking about on both sides of what many characterize, and I think the polls indicate, is a divide in which there is mistrust and fear and lack of respect, polls show, on both sides of the Muslim, if you will, and Western divide, though I hate to say that because they're not that is simply I think where we are today, but it is not an essential or natural divide. And the Alliance of Civilizations Media Fund, in this research that will be fully presented, or more fully presented, at the end of this year, but what we are talking about to some extent tonight, is an attempt to present scientific analysis or evidence of how different groups respond to media depictions of members of their own groups or members of other groups in a range of different situations. And what the research has shown is some of what we've been talking about tonight, that the media has enormous power to perpetuate or generate intergroup bias. And you use the example of Rodney King, did you earlier? And if you think about imagery of Gaza, or if you think about the recruitment videos made by extremists using Abu Ghraib and other kinds of imagery that you know, strike, as they would in any culture, right at the heart of pride and self-respect and of what has also been proven in our research, the power of perceived humiliation that that kind of imagery causes in fomenting rage and a need to regain self-esteem and also to act out on behalf of those being seen to be humiliated or assaulted or attacked. The media's role in communicating social norms that inform our biases, and we've seen both, we've made some references to how that occurs. And if you look in this country, which was one of the departure points for the media fund's work and looking at research as a very essential component of it, if you looked at the impact that the Cosby Show had on, and the Jeffersons, I think it was, on really transforming the media image of African Americans in this country, and the impact that had on both African American communities and their own self-esteem and sense of identity within the larger American society. We, you know, are now taking that beyond onto a cross-cultural level, if you will. And the point you already made about how our attitudes and beliefs are so much informed by our emotions, how our emotions are affected, which of course is a component part of everything I've already said. So we are, the Alliance of Civilizations Media Fund is focusing on the research as a means to reach people like you, to reach industry leaders, those who are producing media in different forms, the media content, trying to promote a greater awareness and consciousness of the impact that these stories and the way that they're told and the nuancing that can take place that will not undermine the commercial viability of a film, but also be a more responsible, constructive, and peace-building, if you will, approach to that awesome power that we've been discussing.
I mean, thank you, Your Majesty. I do want to pick up on this issue of the social norms issue, because one of the things that the research showed is about this issue of social norms and how, you know, we subconsciously calibrate our attitudes around what we believed to be social norms, you know, what we think society will accept. Again, correct me if I'm wrong here, Emanuele, but and that we get a lot of that information through the media, what we see presented in the media. So when you talk about the Cosby Show, I mean, I met about a month ago with Alvin Poussin, who Bill Cosby had asked to serve. He is a psychiatrist, actually, at Harvard, and he served as script consultant upon Cosby's request for all of the scripts that went through the Cosby Show, because Cosby very openly said to him, "I'm concerned that there are no African-American script writers in the room, and I think we're going to, it's likely that we'll fall back into the same old storylines of broken homes and drug violence and this kind of thing, and I want a different kind of program. Will you be a script consultant and vet every script and help to both make them more authentic about what growing up in this country as an African American is like, and also help to purge some of these sort of more sensationalistic and fallback tropes?" And Poussin was very articulate, and he was very powerful in talking to me about how the impact that that had, not just on others, as you were saying, views of African Americans, but the number of African American students, he said, who came through Harvard Medical School, where he now is, who told him that they actually first got the idea of being a doctor by seeing a doctor on television. They hadn't met an African American professional. Seeing a middle class family with a lawyer mother and a doctor father broadened the thinking for a lot of people about what the social norms could be. Now, picking up on this, one of the things that we've done is work with a number of other organizations on an initiative called Muslims on Screen and Television, which meets with script writers, producers, and researchers for existing popular programming, and doesn't put any pressure on them, but invites them if they want to introduce a Muslim character into one of their programs, not because it's nice to Muslims, because that does not sell in Hollywood. I think you're absolutely right on that. But because it makes good drama, good sitcoms, and it'll make for a more popular and compelling program, that we can help. And the other organizations we work with can help. We can provide introductions to baseline characters. You want to write in a Muslim American journalist, we'll introduce you to 10 of them who can be baseline characters. You want to know what the same role that Poussin played. You want to know what a name might be, or what a food might be, or what might be an authentic storyline. We can help with that. And it's a service. It's not a pressure technique. And that's the only way, because I think what you've said is really, you know, you put us right up against it. There's the commercial imperative, and nothing really competes with that.
And by the way, there's an enormous receptivity to this information. I think many of, at least of the members of the Media Fund have found who are involved in production of films in Hollywood, it, when they have tried to help better nuance characters and situations, they found that there was a real openness to that kind of information and a willingness to respond, which I think they were startled by. We weren't, you know, so convinced that there would be that kind of response.
I want to turn it open to the audience in the last half an hour, but I want to give each of the panelists to respond also, as Ben, you put some things on the table. First, we'll go back to you if you've got a reaction here. Then I want to turn to the three of you if you want to say something before we go back.
Mike. Can you all hear me? The mic's okay? Is it working? Use this one.
Don't worry, that's
they gave stuff. Me this one so I could talk even louder. Thank you very much. but I wanted to say, you know, the obvious and necessary work has to do with character and the role of Muslims and so on. Cosby family is an example. But a lot of what goes on is invisible, and we don't see it. Let me do a little test there. I'm going to say a word, and you tell me what first comes to your brain. Terrorist. What's in your head now? What's in your head? Really, honestly, even the right? It's an Arab.
Tamil tiger.
We say. Thank you. Thank you, Your Majesty. But here's, I was working with Bill Clinton in the 1990s, and when Oklahoma City happened, everyone said this is an act of terrorism, and everybody assumed this was going to be some kind of a, you know, Muslim terrorist event. It turned out to be an American. We had a terrorist event yesterday in Washington, D.C., and it was an American neo-Nazi, 88 years old. I don't know how he got that old and kept all of his prejudices intact, but
you know, they get worse.
But he did. It does get, you get older the way you're younger, I guess. It gets worse, not better. And a couple weeks ago, we had the murder of a doctor by a terrorist. We tend, though, not to use the word, although it fits the formal conceptual definition of somebody who uses violence to impose an ideology on people, about people to whom it applies, but who belong to our group, it's easy to use on others. So it may be that Hollywood can make some adjustments and have a Muslim doctor and a Muslim teacher. Guess who's coming to dinner? My Muslim, you know, fiancé. Isn't that nice? You know, and we'll get that far, but it's not going to get to the point where it stops talking about terrorism and terrorists. The greatest thing I believe President Obama did in Cairo was something he didn't say, not something he said. He didn't use the word terrorist. He simply stayed away from that word, understanding that the associations in that part of the world, it's understood as a kind of form of slander, even though technically clearly it applies to some of the behavior of some of the people in that part of the world, just as like it applies to a lot of the behavior in our part of the world to American Protestants and seculars to also do terroristic acts. So we have to also think about the role of language and terms, which may not just be about cultural stereotypes, but may be about the way we attach prejudice to certain terms that don't seem to be related to issues that are on the table, but in fact really are.
Well, thank you. And you're bringing us back down to earth every time we try and get up, but that's the role, and we appreciate it very much. And I do want to turn to the audience unless there's a burning response.
I Muhammad, have a burning response.
Burn.
Sorry, Your Majesty. Well, I only wanted to share an observation here since the president's speech was just brought up. We actually had the privilege of meeting the public engagement team at the White House one day after the president's speech. And it was very, very clear to us that there is really a change in direction. The representatives of the public engagement team told us that we do not ever want to use words such as counter this or anti that. It is a completely proactive approach to engaging with the Muslim community, and we as our possible partners moving forward would like to make it very known. So I just wanted to emphasize in this case from a personal observation that political leadership can also help tremendously in changing social norms and the openness of the society as a whole to the Muslim community. That's all.
Please, sir.
No, it was the thing why I think this can keep going on and so effective, and why Hollywood is selling so many tickets when they tell these stories these ways, in my experience, is because we really need to confirm our superiority. We're very afraid, and then I'm talking for Europe, but this was the case when I developed my play. When I saw the women that were mostly afraid of hearing the other stories and had to keep shouting that they were suppressed, they must be suppressed, find the stories they're suppressed, it was because they needed to confirm they were liberated. And it was because they're insecure. And in that way, if I put it then for Europe, I could imagine that the Europe identity, we're insecure. We don't know what we are anymore. We need to be, then we see some people that have an identity and are very secure. we can't handle. That's too threatening. So we had to put them down, you know. We have to make stereotypes there, because in that way we keep confirming every time again that we're the superior in this play.
Well, whatever you were going to say before, Manuela, I have to ask you to respond to that. This is exactly your research. No, I mean, much of it. Please respond to that, and then we'll turn it over to the audience.
I don't know about Europeans having low self-esteem. It's you know, as I was mentioning before, it's always an issue of self-definition. You know, by depicting the other in a certain way, you're also depicting yourself, and by otherness, you define yourself. So I think, you know, there is a certainly one of the most well-documented tendency in psychological research is the need for a stable, secure, and positive self-esteem at the individual level. But we also derive this from collective level, from our membership in a variety of groups. And therefore, there is the possibility of that. I mean, the little research that addresses specifically this question doesn't seem to find a link between what we call out-group, in-group love and out-group hate. They seem to be somewhat related, but also by and large independent. And so it's, you know, there's no, as I'm answering as an academic here, there's no enough evidence for me to give you a clear-cut answer on that. But I wouldn't say that it's necessarily always a consequence of a need to establish a positive self-esteem. It may be a component at different times. But can I quickly follow up on something that in regard to with the specific dimension of the lance and what Her Majesty was mentioning before. When we hear this intervention in media and the depiction, you know, more positive depiction of Muslims, we've seen this for women, for particularly in advertising. A debate has been going on in this country for 20 years, certainly for gay and so on, and other minorities. There is often criticized as people want to do social engineering. I think this is really such a false start, because we don't realize that we're always doing social engineering, whatever we are depicting. And the issue that we have with media, as Benjamin says, is depicting a reality that is one particular reality. The issue is to be, in a way, to change and make it more diverse and be more representative. So in a way, it's the opposite of social engineering. It's a bit of a more mirroring the reality as opposed to imposing one unilateral reality to the audience.
Well, thank you. No, that's very helpful to hear, actually. We have a mic to run, and we have... Yes.
Stand up and to ask a question rather than make a comment. The question can
first raise your hand, and I'll point to you, and then you can stand up, please.
So
I'll start in the blue shirt here. In the blue, yes, please, you.
Hi. My question is, what about the other direction? You know, I think we need to be involved. I think you need to be involved in also somehow addressing the perception of Westerners in Muslim societies, because I think it goes both ways. Somehow there's also that stereotype. Does your media initiative deal with that at all?
Would you like to? Okay. Well, I will tell you briefly, one of the two places where we're doing our primary work are one in Hollywood and two in the Middle East. The research findings that we are coming out with towards the end of this year, we have an agreement from the Dubai Film Festival to translate all of them into Arabic. We're going to be writing it up and to distribute it at the film festival to Arab world media leaders. That's, as Ben has properly pointed out, a very small percentage, actually, of the larger Muslim world. But in this issue, and not surprisingly, President Obama also reflected this in terms of where he spoke and what he spoke about, what's going on in the Middle East is it's the primary fault line for a lot of the political issues and the issues of relationships. So that's the first thing that we're doing, is we're making sure that the research gets out there. We're having a panel dedicated to us at the festival to talk about it. And we're looking at launching a Middle East film, short film competition connected to a reality TV program, where people could watch the short films that are created and vote on those that they most like. And the Dubai Festival, the end of next year, will screen the winners, and the top 10 candidates will have immediate acceptance to a number of film training programs. The Tribeca Institute here in New York has already offered 3 slots. The Middle East Media Foundation, based in Abu Dhabi, is offering 10 slots, and the Royal Film Commission in Jordan is offering slots. So we're also doing work there, and the theme of the film, which is getting at your issue, is very much around media for social change, biases and stereotypes that need to be torn down in your society and targeted at young people. very
and
much
these are
people.
Universals, so, is the idea.
Yes.
So, in fact, they apply. And the King Hussein Foundation's Media and Humanity Program actually has looked in for our special emphasis actually has been within the Middle East, and we've been looking within the Middle East actually for film content that is humanizing groups on either side of the conflict lines, with special emphasis on the Arab-Israeli conflict. So we have had very hard time actually finding film product that was not just one side or the other, but in fact was balanced. So far, the two of the best films that we've shown over the last several years at the Tribeca Film Festival have been produced, one by an Israeli-Palestinian partnership and the other by an Israeli, but the stories were about Israelis and Palestinians coming to discover one another's humanity in the context of you know, very unique sort of situations.
To Mohammed and then Ben.
Yeah, I have a very, very small plug to mention here. The world's largest Muslim lifestyle network is based in Finland. Over half of the users are actually based in Europe and North America, so they're already very much Western. And this is something, you know, the tools are out there for whoever wants to use them, and I believe that this is another subtle way of changing the idea all around the world of who Westerners are, because Westerners are, some of them are also Muslims.
I mean, it is a pity. There's a film some of you have seen called The Band, about an Egyptian band that gets caught up in the wrong town in Israel. It's a charming, wonderful film, and, you know, good for peace and so on. For political reasons, the culture minister of Egypt has not been willing to release that film in Egypt, which is, you know, really a pity. So you're right, it needs to be a two-way process. But I have to say, as the author of Jihad versus McWorld, the fact is McWorld, Hollywood, American television are already everywhere. So that if you are living in the Muslim world, well, I totally agree, there ought to be more exposure to the humanistic outside. The fact is there's an awful lot of exposure to the films, the television programs, the advertising of McWorld. Coca-Cola is everywhere. Nike is everywhere. And they have their own invisible ideologies attached to them. So while we need a balance, the situation doesn't start with bias on both sides, and we've got to be open to the other side. They have to be open to us. We start with a world in which the dominant ethos is the ethos of commercial McWorld. And so there's a lot of pushing back against that. And while that does not exonerate folks in the Middle East from trying to have a more balanced, real picture, whether it's of Israel or the United States or the West, there is a certain unbalance in the starting situation that makes it a little more difficult to get, you know, the balanced thing you hope for, where, you know, we CNN's in Cairo and Al Jazeera's in New York, you know, that's very nice. But the fact is, there's an awful lot of us already there in the commercial world.
This is, in fact, why the program we developed for the Middle East is quite different. It's not about getting American characters into productions made locally, because American characters are all over the media waves, a whole range of them. But there is an issue about mobilizing and giving platforms and voices to young people who want to use media for social change for exactly the same purposes, dealing with diversity issues and this kind of thing. What I'd like to do, because if we do it, if I continue this way, we'll get only one more question and response. I'd like to take three questions, and then we'll turn to our panelists. So I'll take three. I'll start. You've been waiting here. I'm going to.
So, my question is double folded. We are talking about media as a catalyst. Isn't it more up to the public to do advocacy to the media, how media should be? Because the problem is the media, and your kind of talking is like we are the victims, and we are. So the issue is that what do we do, and who is doing advocacy? And then I'm curious, since we are talking about Europe more than we should have been talking about the United States and the films, I would like to know if you can compare how media covers Islam and Muslim issues in Europe as compared with the United States. And when I'm talking about media, I'm talking about press, because that's knowledge more than...
Okay, thank you.
It's a very good point, because there's a dramatic difference between the way international stories, and especially those of us in the Middle East notice how the Middle East is covered in the United States on mainstream U.S. Channels and in Europe. There's a completely different... there's almost no coverage here of international affairs in general on the mainstream television channels that are viewed by the majority of people. You have to look really hard. You cannot find Al Jazeera International. Maybe you can in New York, but I can't find it anywhere. And it's an excellent channel. It is modeled on BBC, but it is balanced and it is professional, and it is not simply a translation of Al Jazeera in Arabic, which does tend to reflect more the sort of regional biases, much as American channels reflect regional or national biases. But there is a dramatic difference, and you all should be discussing perhaps what is available
Everybody will have a chance to respond, but what I would like to do is, if I could, because there are a couple other people. So I've got one gentleman here, and then the lady here. I'd like to go to each of you.
Okay.
So please.
My question is framed by the fact that I'm African-American and I'm Muslim, and my family is American. I've been for generations and generations. So when you talk about these perceptions of African Americans, what we were talking about Muslims, and you also said, you know, the Cosby Show, this informed me. But this was one of very few over many, many years of programming. And now as a Muslim, I'm kind of getting it from the other side now. And it's like I'm America's worst nightmare, but I'm American. So
at least you're not Mexican, you know.
So the question is what do we do, or what is the path forward when we've seen how long it has taken for African Americans to be recognized, and I can't even say that it's all the way there now. I mean, we've obviously made great strides. How do we do this? How do we move things forward for Muslims as well? I'm Muslim, but I'm not Arab. I'm as American as anybody else here. So how do we move this forward so that it doesn't take as long?
Thank you. Here, can we bring the microphone over here?
Thank you. Yes, I'd like to focus on language and the fact that there is this proliferation of new language that continues to be developed by academia and the media, and that has primarily the sole purpose of demonizing and marginalizing the Muslim globally. So I'm wondering, in the context of creating a consciousness around how to liberate ourselves from our prejudices, how do we begin to address the disuse of terms like jihadist, Islamist, Muslim versus the West, those kinds of terms. And when we have people who are good-willed trying to mitigate some of the issues, beginning to incorporate the use of those terms themselves. So what do we do about kind of reclaiming language, or just disregarding it and creating new language? I don't know, but it's problematic.
Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to give each of you an opportunity to respond to any of the questions that have come. So please, I know that...
Yeah, well,
Andrea.
One thing I agree straight away when you say we can't victimize and say it's the media, because I'm sorry to say, but we are the media. The media is writing what we're buying, what we want to read. In my play, we gave the audience three of the stories we knew they wanted to have. And then we decided that was only one third of the part, and I think the newspapers are doing it the opposite around, maybe. But we have a huge responsibility as consumers in deciding where and what we buy and where and what we see. It's not just products, it's what we choose to see on the channel, when we choose to zap away, which internet site we choose to visit. Because what they're doing is they want to sell newspapers. They want to sell news, and what's selling is what we're eating. So, I mean, I agree with you, we can't say it's them, it is us. And therefore, it's really nice to have the good opinions, but what is much more harder and more difficult is to have the behavior that goes together with it, and I think it's hard to make the change. I see it's hard to make the change as well.
I have a small thing to say here about Macworld. Our company helps mainstream brands directly address and engage with Muslim consumers, and we are sometimes asked the question, aren't you really trying to, you know, this consumerism, you're really trying to build something that is new to Muslim culture? And I say that Muslims are already consumers, they're already customers of all of those big brands, but what the missing part here is those brands recognizing consumers as a valuable consumer segment and then perhaps not supporting the medias that portray Muslims in an unfair manner. So I think that this could also be, again, part of the Macworld. It doesn't conflict with anything, and it could be another way of changing social norms.
Ben, I'd like to turn... Oh, Emmanuel, please go ahead.
Oh,
and then Ben.
Very quickly about the question on language. And it's a very good question, and every year when I teach my classes on social psychology and I discuss research on prejudice, most of the research is done on prejudice against African Americans, so that's what the most evidence is presented. And I always have a couple of students, African Americans, in my class asking that question, like, aren't you reifying these categories and contributing to this? It's always an embarrassing moment. I get this every year, and every year is still embarrassing. I don't really have an answer for that. I think that hopefully we don't have to really eliminate these categories, but words, but try to change the implicit and explicit associations that people have with these categories.
Let me answer first the question that was asked at the back about. It's not really the media's fault because it's the people who don't tell the media what they want. And it's true in general, commercial capitalism is always saying, we just give people what they want. That's always what they say. They spend billions in advertising and marketing and to shape young people, and they advertise to four-year-olds and they market to two-year-olds. But they say, we just give two-year-olds what they want, you know, as if two-year-olds start with a set of desires and so on. So there is a dialectic. It's true we shouldn't turn consumers into victims. They are complicit in the choices they make, but it's also true that the mass media and commercial capitalism has a lot to do with shaping what it is that people want. There is a top-down as well as a bottom-up, and I want to say particularly about tough issues where people do horrendous things, as happened in Rwanda or happened in Serbia in the 1990s, it's what a lot of people don't know is that the genocide started, the genocide against Muslims in Serbia and Croatia started as a campaign on the radio from Belgrade Radio. It was top down. It was a government-inspired official attempt to stir up old hatreds that actually had been, maybe they were there, but for generations and generations, they were dormant and people were living together. They were stirred up. Hutu Tutsis, same thing in Rwanda. They had lived together for quite a long time. Yes, there were hostilities. Yes, there were resentments about an aristocratic tribe against a less aristocratic tribe. But the reality is it was radio stations spouting for months messages of hate and actually instructing people what to do that inspired and got that genocide to work. Did it count on deeply seated resentments and hatred that is part of being a human being? Yes. Would have it happened without a irresponsible, top-down, elite-inspired media? My answer is no, and I think that's true of the media, too. I mean, the media once had their own responsibility as the fourth estate, as part of educating the civic republic, turning us into good citizens, informing us, deepening the discussion, and instead, in the name of profit, it has totally abandoned that role and sees its only role to make a profit for its shareholders in whatever way it can do that. And if it can do that through education, fine, but education doesn't pay too big. It's much easier to do it the way it does it. So though I completely agree we don't want to turn ourselves as consumers into victims, we do have a role to play. The fact is there is a powerful top-down component in commerce, in media, in advertising and marketing that make it very, very tough for those who want to, from the bottom up, say, we want something different than you are giving us. And we want to remember that. So while we ourselves change the demand structure, we also have to go to the suppliers and find ways politically and elsewise to change what the supply is, to change what the top-down messages are, or they will use their monopoly control of the media, whether it's a state in Africa or the Middle East or commercial media here, corporately owned commercial media, they will use, in the name of giving people what they want, will continue to perpetrate, whether it's genocide or the corruption of young people, they will continue to use the media in ways that your foundation, I think, is trying to challenge.
Your Majesty.
On one of the points you made, organizations like Search for Common Ground are in fact using the lessons of the horrors of the Balkans, of Rwanda, in Africa and other parts of the world, to use radio and to use media, in fact, for constructive purposes. I think one of the things we haven't talked enough about, but it has come up, is the impact of politics on what journalists and media entities on the approach that they take to different subjects. And in this country, we've seen that it very, very clearly and over the past eight years. Really stunning interaction or impact of government policy and attitudes on news media in particular that actually didn't play their role, abdicated their responsibilities completely, which is what happens during times of crisis, which are some of the moments you were referring to. So one of the good things is, on the question of academia, on the question of language, on the question of, you made the point, Shamil, of political leaders who actually can, and we've seen this in our region and their examples. They're rare, unfortunately, and so ever so precious, but political leaders can have a transformative impact on whether a country, a region, world affairs. And today, President Obama, and I don't want to overdo the impact of President Obama's speech, which I've talked at length about and so many others have, but there was an attention to language and to nuancing, to history, to culture, to political realities. There is a discussion of mutual respect and interests. There is a window that is being provided us, I think, to work with. He can't do it by himself. He's going to face incredible pushback as well. We all have an obligation, I think, this is just one of our many responsibilities, but to try to support and engage in whatever ways we can. Everybody here can engage in some fashion or another to support the spirit and the, more than that, what actually can be accomplished in terms of bridging divides, that he is opening some space for discussion, for dialogue, for from the top down, a new kind of approach. And how do we move all of this forward? Well, I think this festival should be an annual festival, and it is one very, very real, concrete way. And I think the attendance at the festival is one indication of how hungry people are for understanding, for knowledge, for different perspectives, not just the Muslim community, but people of so many different communities. I think what we're trying to do at Alliance of Civilizations Media Fund is one modest component part that is bringing together different kinds of entities, both new media, old media, or conventional media, and social activists and others to try to look at these issues. But as I said, as our panelists have said and demonstrated in their own lives and their own work, there are so many different ways. The most important thing, and I think it's critical now, is that everyone engage and support those voices. And as I said, there's one voice here now that needs all the support possible to really fulfill the transformative potential of this new period.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to just one more comment from the floor, and then we're going to wrap it up here. Yes, please.
Hi, I'm Karen Hopkins, the president of BAM, and so as a co-organizer of the festival, I'm very happy to hear this panel. This festival, with the 9 associate partners, the 3 presenting partners, the 50 events, the 300 artists and scholars and intellectuals, and 23 countries involved, has been a major undertaking. But it leads me to a final question of how do you see that we can move art and culture to have a larger role at the diplomacy table?
If I may, I think that what Her Majesty has just said is critically important, because whatever you want to do to make that happen, you either have a context that's open to it or not. Right now, the context is open to it. Funds that were otherwise maybe obsessively targeted purely towards hard security, counterterrorism issues are now being expanded and diversified to include outreach, cultural exchange. There is an appropriations bill moving through Congress right now to make available, with no licensing costs, media of this type. Now, they're talking about nonfiction, documentaries, internationally. And there's been funding from the Ford Foundation to do the reverse, to bring media from all over the world through ITVS, I forget what ITVS stands for now, here to the States. It's been broadcast on a number of different stations, cable and main stations. But so there is an opening now. I think, you know, I hate to go fall back on the tried and true contact congressmen, contact senators, but there are bills now. This appropriations bill is a critically important one. We are hoping with the main foundation that's moving that forward, the Ford Foundation, we just had this meeting yesterday, to try and advance exactly the same kind of legislation for fictional programming, which is the entertainment media, which is the beast, you know, and hopefully use it, you know, identifying those kinds of programs. And they are out there. Sometimes they're hard to find, especially if you're going at the toughest nut to crack like Israel-Palestine. But there are things out there to make those things available free of licensing. So I think there are steps that could be taken. I do want to say one, first I want to thank the panelists. And I think what I should do here, we have 2 minutes, is give you each just 30 seconds, if I could, for any final comments you have. 2.5 minutes. And we'll close it out. So Ben, please, 30 seconds.
Two things. First, with respect to BAM, the Brooklyn Academy, Karen, you know I'm also a supporter of the Brooklyn Academy, a supporter of these things. And one thing we want to do is not just enlist artists and the arts in this campaign, but embrace artists and the arts where they already are, because they're there already. They don't need to be enlisted in a campaign. Supporting the arts is a powerful way to support cosmopolitanism, humanitarianism, and global understanding, and they don't have to be transformed into something other than they are. We are currently cutting the arts badly. To me, that is a problem from the point of view of the understanding we are talking about. Just a second point, quickly, about language, African Americans. The great thing about language is it's dynamic. It evolves. It changes all the time. And I think part of the answer to your question and to your query is that we have to constantly be helping language to change in ways that embrace the new realities. One of the realities you pointed out, that an awful lot of African Americans are Muslims. And there are also white Americans who are from a Christian backgrounds who have embraced Islam, have converted to Islam. So there are many different kinds of Muslims. One of the words that I use, this is the last point I want to make.
I'll donate my 30 seconds.
Last word. There's a terrible word, and I shouldn't use it, but I'm using it only descriptively. The word you all know is the word that's been used to defame and hurt people of color forever. It's the word nigger. But in the 1960s, Dick Gregory, wonderful comedian, wrote an autobiography, and he named it nigger. And what he said was, "Mom, now you know whenever you hear that word, they're just talking about my book." Now, this was a way in which he tried to transform the weight and gravity of that word. But that happens all the time, and we need to be totally aware of that change of language in that sense.
Thank you. Yeah. Manuel.
Well, Benjamin made a pitch for the arts. I made a pitch for scientific research. I think it's hopefully we will continue to support and also support a different kind of research, more engaged, more action-oriented, intervention-oriented. And I think some of the things that are coming out from the Alliance are certainly in that direction. And my wish is that also from as an academic, that we really become more engaged as opposed to retreat in our labs. And I think that's my wish for the future. And certainly I hope that the times have changed. And as Her Majesty pointed out, is a good context to be engaged. It's a good time. And it's probably the moment in which some difference can be made by each of us.
Well, yeah, we are storytelling creatures, so I would say remember to share your stories and especially listen to stories, and that's where we have a choice which stories you listen to.
Thank you.
Well, I got it anyway. I'd like to encourage everybody to utilize new media, which will really not require a lot of time investment on your part. Muslim, non-Muslim, Westerner, from the East, really try to use new media to engage with other cultures and communities, and you will really find things that are really fascinating.
You don't have a specific site in mind, do you? Your Majesty.
Salaam alaikum.
Wonderful. Peace.
I would like... I would like to, of course, thank all of you. Thank my partner, Karen Hopkins, the president of BAM, Vishaka Desai, the president of the Asia Society, Mustafa Tlili, the founder and director of the Center for Dialogues at NYU, Manaz Fancy, who helped us so much put this together, Zeba Rahman, without whom I wouldn't have been able to do this, all of our panelists here today, Her Majesty Queen Noor, for coming. Everybody here has contributed greatly. In a way, you have pontificated in the true sense of the word. Build a bridge. I hope we will be able to walk over that bridge. I do hope we will be able to do many more programs like this, maybe not with 19 European countries coming together, because I feel like I've aged by 19 years. Mm-hmm. And I will also say that please stay for the next panel if you can. I think there's still some tickets available upstairs. I'm sure all of you will want to hear more of what Benjamin Barber has to say, and he will be here for the second panel. So, Shamil, thank you so much for instigating this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you so much.